Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. Joining me as ever is the Serena to my Venus, Dallas King. Dallas, how are you?
Apparently the greatest of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I've earned a lot of money. You're the number one of all time. That's a pretty good combination, I think. But we took last week off because there was next to nothing to really report on in the cinemas. But
well, apparently somebody wasn't willing to watch Red Notice on Netflix, so I blame you for having nothing to talk about last week.
Have you seen Red Notice?
Of course I have. It's got the Dwayne The Rock Johnson in it. Of course I watched it.
Is it? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because you and your dad would usually watch that kind of a rock film together, wouldn't you?
Yeah, obviously more difficult with Netflix. No, if it gets a cinematic release, then we'll go. But I think it was more Prince Charles for like a few days and then onto Netflix. So it's what you expect. No one is playing anything other than themselves, and it's your standard heist, spy, you know, chase plot movie with Nazi gold, as you do.
I noticed like Netflix have said like it's not like such and such amount of people watched it. It was like 250 million hours of Red Notice has been watched, which is the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And that takes some doing from Netflix. They always seem to kind of fudge the numbers a little bit. Like, if someone's watched 3 minutes of a movie, we're going to count that as a viewer and stuff. But this felt like an odd one from them.
Yeah, I mean, it is over 2 hours. So, I mean, I don't know how that equates and whatever. But I think there was a thing going around at the weekend or something where people were taking the mickey out of a tweet that, you know, I think it was like Ryan Reynolds had tweeted that, you know, it was Netflix's most popular new film on opening weekend or whatever. And then people were just basically putting up, you know, things that they've accomplished and the source being themselves. you know we could say that, you know, Filibuster is, you know, the most listened to podcast in the world ever, and the source being us on this podcast. So there you go, Filibuster is the most listened to podcast in the whole world. Why? Because we said so. Why? Because you know, if you count up all the seconds as opposed to minutes, you know, then yeah, that's right. Yeah, something like that.
All those podcasts are like 3 hours long have clearly got us screwed over. Like, damn, we should, instead of doing like 30-minute, 40-minute episodes, we should just like start ramping them up into like 5-hour epics once a month. Just sit back and go, we are the most popular podcast in the world. Probably, you know, second would be obviously the A24 project.
Of course.
I mean, yes, that goes without saying, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I still think I was incredibly impressed that we managed to, you know, get a podcast out pretty much every week last year when there was next to nothing being released. So.
Yeah, because it's an interesting one this week, because it's a packed week in the cinema with a pair of big releases.
We've hit the logjam. The floodgates have opened and everything that was sitting on the shelves is now having to come out.
Exactly. We've got like a big pair of releases with like Ghostbuster Afterlife and King Richard. And then we've got some interesting kind of counter programming with The Power of the Dog and Petite Maman thrown in. So firstly, you know, if anyone follows us on social media, they'll have noticed we're giving away 2 copies of Star Trek Discovery Season 3 and Lower Decks Season 1 on Blu-ray, which is really exciting. So we're going to keep that running till the end of the week. So follow us on at Join Nerd Party if for your chance to win that and give the tweet a retweet. But you know, I had the chance, you know, season 4 of Discovery was meant to drop in the UK last week, and they decided at the last minute that it was going to be pulled from Netflix altogether. So I decided to dive into Discovery season 3 in the week before season 4 came out to get myself prepared for that, and while I didn't have season 4 on the other end of it, it was really good to sort of dive back into season 3. And you know, I mentioned it before, and we did a sort of Discovery recap with Carlos Miranda, that season 2 of Discovery was a bit of a mixed bag for me. And I think the problem that I had with Discovery was it was trapped too much in the past, you know, well, their past, our future. And they have decided to rectify that by traveling a further 930 years into the future and kind of breaking free. And you know, for Star Trek fans like myself, I think that's something we've all been wanting for quite a while, is We've not really been in the future since sort of 2001, two, since Star Trek Nemesis came out. So it's been exciting to sort of see this brand new world. And I think for people that follow Star Trek Discovery, the first few seasons were constantly changing showrunners. We had Brian Fuller, and then Brian Fuller left before a single episode was released, and kind of up and downs over the first two seasons. But Michelle Paradise has really made it her own the past couple of years and this past season. And I think the highlight for me is we've got a really good supporting cast in Star Trek Discovery, and I think season three and hopefully into four is going to start making kind of use of them. You know, we've seen a lot more of these kind of characters that surround our main characters, and it feels like we've got a bit of a bridge crew now, which is exciting. So, you know, season three had some really interesting highlights and one I enjoyed, so hopefully it won't be too long a wait for season four. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it, and hopefully people can get their chance to win it on Blu-ray, because you can't watch on Netflix anymore. Blu-ray and DVD are now the only way to watch Star Trek Discovery. So yeah, that's definitely sorts a lot of people's Christmas presents out to be the completionists, I think.
Physical media for the win. And speaking of things which are trapped in the past and not the future...
Ghostbusters Afterlife. So, when a single mom and her two kids arrive in a small town, they begin to discover their connection to the original Ghostbusters and the secret legacy that their grandfather left behind. So, Dallas, I know that you've written a review about this, but I, as always, I've kept myself away from it. You're a bit more of a Ghostbusters fan than I am. So, can you tell me a little bit about your expectations going in and that reaction?
I mean, I have friends who are like diehard Ghostbusters fans. Like, I remember when I was working at the Belmont, I put on a private screening of the original Ghostbusters for their 30th birthday, and they came in their, you know, homemade proton packs, and someone was dressed as a ghost, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. So I know people who are diehard fans. I am a fan, you know, but at the same time as being a fan of the original two films, I also found, you know, some elements to enjoy in the Ghostbusters, you know, by Paul Feige in 2016, you know, Kate McKinnon, I thought was fantastic. I appreciated Chris Hemsworth's comic turn in that, you know, before he was able to showcase his comic chops in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, this was a great thing for him. You know, I can understand why, well, I can understand why people would be upset at the idea that this was basically, well, the 2016 one was basically a complete reboot as opposed to a continuation of the story, because, you know, certain people like Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson were in the film, but they weren't the original characters. I don't think it deserved the internet treatment that it got. I think it's a fine film in itself. So, you know, when they said they were going to do another one, I mean, I think if I can remember correctly, it pretty much filmed, and they'd completed filming before they actually even announced it, which was, you know, impressive to be able to shoot something in complete secrecy these days, you know, given the internet. So when it was announced, and I think that first sort of teaser trailer dropped with, you know, the music in it, and then the Ecto one under the tarp in the barn and stuff like that, I was like, ooh, okay. You know, Jason Reitman, you know, I've enjoyed some of his work. For me, my favourite film of his was Young Adult, but I can understand the need to, you know, continue the franchise. But also, it's a hell of a burden, you know, growing up in the shadow of your dad, who made, you know, one of the most successful, you know, comedies and sort of science fiction films of all time. You know, to be able to go back into that is a huge gamble, but for me, I think it paid off. I mean, it's impossible not to watch the film and just see Don Draper in Mad Men going, nostalgia, it's delicate but potent. I don't think there's anything delicate about the nostalgia in this film. It is dripping with nostalgia and ectoplasm in every single scene, to the point where I can imagine some people will not appreciate it and feel that it should have maybe paid a little bit of a homage, moved on, tried to do its own thing. This, for me, was very much The Force Ghost Awakens in it paid tribute to the past. It set out its stall for the future, but then also in actually, what are we, we're about 2 weeks since it came out, so I think we can probably talk about some plot points. Essentially, it like Force Awakens, it actually just recycles a lot of the plot of the first one, with the terror dogs and a certain returning ghostly character. We'll get onto that in a bit, I imagine. But for me, yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I got sucked in by all the callbacks and stuff like that. What about yourself?
Yeah, I'm not really much of a Ghostbusters fan. I watched the first one just only a couple of years ago. I think they re-released it in cinemas just before Ghostbusters 2016 came out. So I finally got around to watching that. I mean, it's a good movie, yeah. I enjoy it fine enough. I wasn't a fan of the 2016 movie outside of sort of Kate McKinnon. I just thought it was terrible. I did like the cartoon series a little bit when I was a kid.
Oh, the real Ghostbusters, yeah.
That was my stuff. And
did you have the toys?
I didn't have the toys, but I had friends that had the toys. I remembered someone that had the car and things like that. But I was more sort of into my, obviously, Star Trek, for example, than Ghostbusters when it came to raiding the Toys R Us aisle. So it was one of those things, like, I went into it with a bit of a Ghostbusters fan, and I just was immediately... I was into sort of, like, I get it when there's, like, nostalgia, and it's just... But just not nostalgia that I am particularly interested in or resonates with me, like... I was watching it going, I'm pretty sure this is like the last quarter of the film is like the first movie. Like, I can remember it back that way, and I was like, oh my God, they did that again. And I was just sort of confused about some of the stuff that was getting kind of dropped in, like the marshmallow person, for example. I was like, why is the marshmallows in the shop? Like, it's one of those things, like, there's some things that are just don't need to be there, that are just hammered in because people remember them. It's, you know, similar to things like Rogue One, for example. And there was just elements where I was just, at one point I actually dozed off for about 5-10 minutes. You know, I was just not engaging with the movie. And I think I got I was really worried when at the start of the film, like, a blue beam goes into the sky and I was like, oh God, we're still doing this. It was just like, it's almost a parody now of action movies having to do that. And, you know, the one thing, I know I'm being quite down on it, but I thought the young girl that played Phoebe was really good. You know,
yeah,
she was
McKenna
just...
Grace is fantastic, yeah, in this, yeah.
Yeah. You just watch her and you go, she's excellent. She gets it. Fantastic. I thought she was excellent, and I could have done it with a bit more of her. You know, Paul Rudd does enough, but not too much. And it's the same for the rest of them. It's just, it should be this little girl's movie. And I know I was getting Stranger Things vibes, but much like Ghostbusters 2, I've only ever seen like 5 minutes of Stranger Things. So I didn't realize that until afterwards. But I kind of like that sort of, like, you know, outside of New York, you know, kind of a young family sort of getting involved in this and a bit of the legacy. It seemed to work quite well, but then it just sort of just all kind of fell apart when it kind of tried to be Ghostbusters again, and it just left me kind of feeling disappointed. And obviously, I'm sure, you know, if you're listening to this bit, I'm sure you've seen Ghostbusters, but I found the use of CGI of a certain actor incredibly disturbing. And I know, I'm sure the family approved it, but I thought it was a bad idea. I think there's a bit where you just see an arm on the gun. That would have been more than enough, but it didn't make sense as well, because they have this big ghost trapping machine, which you would think would ghost trap this person as well. So it's just, I thought it was a really misjudged moment when less would have been more.
Yeah, we'll come on to that, Elias. Yeah, because yeah, no, I totally get the Stranger's vibes and the fact that, yeah, Finn Wolfhard is in this. Actually, sort of thinking about it now, it almost has a bit of a sort of Lost Boys sort of vibe to it as well, with, you know, this family moving to this town, which, you know, has got ghosts in it. Instead of vampires, it's basically, you know, it's got ghosts and stuff like that, and they're trying to fit in this new town and stuff like that. And so it's got a bit of that as well. So, but yeah, no, I mean, the... Paul Rudd for me was essentially me, or any person who grew up with Ghostbusters. It does feel odd that, you know, even though it's been 30 years or something, you know, no one really remembers, you know, an apocalyptic event in New York. And the fact that clearly the two kids had never tried to Google their grandfather before. it's only once Paul Rudd shows them the wonderful clips on YouTube and stuff like that that they managed to figure it out. It's like, oh, you think you would, but yeah, fine, we'll give it a pass, carry on. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the points about, it completely recycles the first film once you get into the sort of final act and stuff like that. The Stay Puffs, I can understand why they're there. You know, that was the brand of marshmallows that was used in the first film. How that brand survived, you know, a potentially damaging incident of a giant marshmallow man destroying New York City, you know, they must have a very strong PR department. But yeah, the because you've got the opening scene, which features a character who is never fully shown, but you know who it is, and you're thinking, okay, where's this gonna go? What are they gonna do with him? Is it a new actor? Are they just gonna not show it? And then they had, like, you know, lamps moving and stuff like that, and that was a really nice way to do it. And you were thinking all the time, you're thinking, what are they gonna do at the end? What are they gonna do at the end? And then, yep, they go with it. They show a certain character who is no longer with us, in ghostly form. They don't speak, which is probably a good thing. I think the way it was done was just about right. I think it looked a lot better than some of the other attempts which we've seen at this type of thing. Could it have been done without? Absolutely. Was it nice to see the original lineup kind of back together? Yes. But, you know, it did work for me, and I know a lot of people who were going to be crying at that moment, just because, in a good way, not in a bad way. Some people are probably crying at it in a bad way, horrified by what they're seeing. But, yeah, no, it did work for me. Seeing the original cast come back, I mean, Bill Murray just looked like he was there doing what he wanted, just making the lines up on the spot and stuff like that. But, yeah, overall, I fell for hook, line, and sinker for the nostalgia factor.
And you know what? That's totally fine. Like, I know people can be down on it, but I mean, there's times where it's been things I've liked, and it plays into that. I'm like, God damn it, it feels really good. And it's one of those things, like, if it works for people, it works. And you know what? The thing I really liked about Ghostbusters Afterlife, apart from probably the parents that were in the cinema, I was maybe sort of one of the more older people there. And there seemed to be a lot of people there with, like, young kids and, you know, people in and around sort of 10 years old, yeah, etc., which I didn't anticipate.
I'm actually really surprised how it has become this sort of family-friendly franchise when, you know, the first film is actually, even though it was just a PG, it was kind of quite dark. I mean, there's the infamous Ray Stantz getting a spectral blowjob from a ghost. So, which, you know, when you're watching it as a kid, you don't realise what's going on. But when you watch it now, you're like, was that always in there? It's like, all right, okay. But yeah, I guess it's just something that us people, as grown-ups, are now showing their kids. And I think Apple TV's got the real Ghostbusters TV show on there that you can buy now. So yeah, kids seem to love it. And this one is very much more tailored towards a younger audience, which, you know, will then send the fanboys into a frenzy going, you know, all the ones that watch The Phantom Menace and Star Wars and stuff and were like, no, Star Wars is meant to be for grown-ups. And it's like, no, Star Wars has always been for kids. I would argue that Ghostbusters probably wasn't always for kids, but once they did the TV show, the cartoon show, then yeah, it probably was. So yeah, I mean, looking forward, I mean, I think they can almost maybe draw a line on it and start moving it in a new direction, even though some of the original cast apparently now have control over it. And I'm pretty sure somebody had said that in the film that, you know, the Ghostbusters firehouse had turned into a Starbucks, but at the end in the post-credits scene, it was still empty. So I don't know what happened with that. I mean, maybe it was just a joke, but that everything gets, you know, commercialized and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, looking at the rental factor in New York, I mean, even a Starbucks, I think, would struggle to make back its money in that kind of building. It was probably owned by Jay-Z now, or Robert De Niro.
So our second big release of the week is King Richard, and also one of the second big film discourses on social media as well this week. So it's a look at how tennis superstars Venus and Serena Williams became who they are after the coaching from their father, Richard Williams. So, you know, I'll kind of go first on this one. Like, I had no real expectations going in. I hadn't seen the trailer. I actually had missed this one in at the London Film Festival because I went to go see the Wes Anderson French Dispatch exhibit instead.
Excellent choice. Though you didn't steal a mug though, did you?
The joy of being one of the first people to go to the exhibit means that I didn't have the confidence that everyone else that's followed to steal has done. So yeah, I was kind of like, oh, I'll go see it. There's been some good buzz about it. I wasn't that excited about it, but I was immediately really, really taken with the film. And it was just one of those ones, like, I didn't really, like, I'm not big into sort of women's tennis. I watch bits of it here and there. It's something I kind of tend to watch with my mom, but it's impossible not to know about Venus and Serena and their incredible achievements. But I didn't really know about their dad. Like, I remembered seeing him about sometimes at Wimbledon being a bit wacky and that, but that was about all it amounted to. And at the end, I came out and went, wow, that was a really good biopic that focused on a very specific period of time, which, you know, I
always
like.
Always the best time.
But my problem, the one thing I went at was like, I was watching going, well, that was a pretty standard biopic. It kind of, you know, it's very good. It's very nice, well acted. You know, it's nothing anything significant. You know, am I being a bit generous thinking this is a really good 4 out of 5? But I couldn't really think of anything to knock it down for. And, you know, I'm usually, the things like that, you think, well, actually, it's a bit cynical, or, you know, it's a bit Oscar baity. With this, I was like, I just really liked the performances and the story and where that went. And to see, you know, a real working class family like that succeed and how they got there. And I thought it was one of Will Smith's best performances in a long, long time. And yeah, I came away just wanting to knock it down for something, because I just didn't feel it. You know, it's like you come out of a film and you're like, of course it's good, I've been caught up in the moment. And then you try and you sometimes come out and go, actually, maybe not so good, or that. And I tried to have that conversation with myself, but King Richard wouldn't budge. And I think that is a testament to the film. I would really encourage people to check it out.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a film which, yeah, no, I mean, I was looking forward to see. I mean, yeah, I'm not a huge tennis fan, but, you know, like when Wimbledon's on, or, you know, when Andy Murray was, you know, I was in New York when Andy Murray won the US Open, so that was fun. But, you know, I mean, when Wimbledon's on, I always sort of have it on and watch it and stuff like that. But, I mean, yeah, it's impossible, even if you don't watch tennis, like you say, to not know of the Williams sisters. So is the discourse currently around the fact that the film is about their dad rather than them? I think that's probably one of them.
Yes, that's correct.
Not about Will Smith's latest comments about that have come out from his autobiography. We'll park them and we'll not come back to those. But you can search Twitter on them, and it's a rather eye-opening experience. But yeah, no, Amish, initially I was kind of like, huh, you know, that's interesting that they would go with the point of the dad. I'm sure the part of the discourse is behind, you know, why they're telling a man's story rather than a woman's story. But apparently, you know, they're executive producers on it. And to be honest, I think having now watched, I think it is the more interesting story. You know, nothing against, you know, the Williams sisters. I mean, what they've done is incredible. But I think if you had done a biopic of those, of either Serena or Venus or both together, it would have been potentially even more cookie cutter, sort of, you know, just following the standard template of, you know, rags to riches and, you know, getting up to the bigs, you know, they win a few matches, then they have a setback and then they come back and do all that stuff. That's how it probably would have been. And it would have been a very generic biopic to actually focus on the dad's point of view and how essentially, you know, he was a rather larger than life personality, but what he was doing, it always seemed like he was doing it for his daughters and for his family. It wasn't, I mean, so certainly in the interviews and stuff, it comes across at times as it's all about him. But in the scenes where he's not in front of a camera and he's just with the family, it does feel like he's doing this for his family. He's doing it for the daughters so they can become stars. And I think that's quite interesting. It's a world away from these, you know, these mums and dads who put their sort of young daughters into these beauty pageants and stuff like that, and it's very narcissistic, and it's, you know, something that maybe they weren't able to achieve as a kid, but you know they can achieve greatness through their children. This was about having great children, essentially, and sort of seeing his struggles, and you know, almost talking about this plan that he had, and actually, because I mean, what they were able to do is just is incredible. Actually, you know, I mean, like they say, you know, African Americans were going straight into the top leagues in sports like basketball, sort of American football and stuff like that. But tennis, it was like pretty much unheard of at that time. And the fact that they were able to do it, two sisters from the same family, is incredible. And yeah, you really get a sense of their struggle. And I think, yeah, Will Smith is easily his best performance for years, probably since maybe even someone like I'm Legend or something like that. Very different performance for him, but great. I think the two sisters were great, and the mum, she gets a scene. Everyone kind of gets like at least one, like maybe slightly Oscar baity scene, where the mum gets it in the kitchen, where she's sort of ragging on Richard about, you know, how he's doing it for his family, but he also is a bit of a hypocrite because he has another part of his family which he never really sees. I think Will Smith's Oscar clip will be the tearful conversation he has with Venus on the tennis court when she's wanting to start competing in competitions and stuff like that. Really rounded cast. I think John Bernthal was a lot of fun as the tennis coach as well. So yeah, no, I think it doesn't reinvent the wheel in terms of biopic structure or anything like that, but I think just the central story and the performances is what carries it to victory, I think.
Another interesting kind of film, I think, that will be in the contention for Oscar kind of discussions will be The Power of Dog, the first film in quite a while from Jane Campion. And it's about the charismatic rancher Phil Burbank, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who inspires fear and awe in those around him. When his brother brings home his new wife and her son, Phil torments them until he finds himself exposed to the possibility of love. So this one will be out on Netflix in a few weeks' time, but you can find it in sort of independent cinemas at the moment until then. So I caught this one at the London Film Festival, and I must admit, it's interesting, you know, we kind of look back, I think Brokeback Mountain, for example, I think it's 20th anniversary, well, maybe 15th anniversary, something like that. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, this revolutionary movie that kind of takes the American West cowboys and puts sort of an LGBT spin on it, that's something kind of new, and it's almost become something that's more and more common as the years have gone by, which is excellent. And I kind of had that feeling going in with The Power of the Dog about another gay cowboy movie. Here we go again. It's becoming kind of a standard indie fare. But I thought what Jane Campion did with this source material, well, it was fantastic. It's a film that I'm real excited to watch again, because where that film goes, I did not see coming that first time. I was genuinely surprised, and it made me reconsider what I was watching that whole time. And like, similar to King Richard, it's a film that maybe doesn't reinvent the wheel, but it does something just that little bit different, and it kind of informs this entire film in a different way. And I think it's one of those ones, I was watching the film, I was like, oh, this is a really good film. I can't maybe picture myself watching this one again. And by the end of the film, I was like, oh my God, how wrong was I? Like, there's so much going on underneath and wanting to kind of dive back again. What was your experience like?
It was a weird one, this one. It was kind of, I was kind of unsure of the film watching it. It was very, I wasn't all that gripped by it while I was watching it. And I was going, am I not seeing what, you know, because I saw it at Glasgow as part of the London Film Festival. So, I mean, some reviews had started to come out and it was getting a lot of praise. And I was like, am I not getting this or something? I mean, Cumberbatch is good in a role where he's probably his most loathsome since Atonement, if anyone can remember all the way back then. He was the bad guy in that. And yeah, it was like, I mean, the score was fantastic. All the cast were great. It was just something was missing for me. And then, you know, I would also call it sort of fear and self-loathing in Montana or something. But it wasn't until the ending, like you said, and then I suddenly went, whoa, hang on. This is not the film. I've been watching the film completely wrong. I didn't realise this was the film. And when I get to the ending, and I'm not going to spoil it, I'm not even going to go into spoilers as to what it is, because it's out on Netflix in a couple of weeks, but I was like, wow, okay, I need to go and see this film again and rewatch it from a different perspective, because yeah, I think I'd just been reading it entirely wrong. You think it's one type of film, but then it's actually a different type of film. And I was like, wow, okay. But yeah, no, it's definitely worth it. And I think, yeah, definitely try and see it on the big screen as well, because I think Campion and the cinematography of the West and stuff like that is definitely worth seeing. Obviously, still a great film if you see it on Netflix, but if you can, try and see it on the big screen.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people this week as well have seen our sort of last film that we're going to talk about, Petite Maman. This was a film that was part of a London Film Festival and was kind of screened up and down the country, and it's the new film from Selena Skimema. So following up from great films like Water Lilies, Girlhood, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I think there's a lot of anticipation for this movie. And it comes with a sweet running time of 72 minutes. It's been bought by Neon, and it'll be out on sort of Mubi here in the UK. So it's got a lot of indie prestige behind it. This was one that it's interesting where I think about, again, discourse seems to be on sort of my mind this week, where there seems to be a lot of discussion about, you know, people love certain films, and if people don't love a certain film, that, you know, they're maybe kind of a, you know, to be thought of less, or there should be some, you know, huge discussion about things like that. This was a film I really liked, but I've not loved it as much as other people, which is a little bit disappointing, but I just love her other films a bit more. But I'm really happy that this film is making the success of it is. Like, I can't believe it's showing in Cineworld. It's on in sort of indie cinemas. It's on in bigger cinemas. Like, this little 72-minute French movie where it's about this little girl that has lost her grandmother and kind of is helping her parents sort of clean out her mother's childhood home. And she explores the house and the surrounding woods. And then one day she meets a girl of the same age building a treehouse, which is safe to say is not sort of a plot that gives away much of this film. And I read a review that I thought just nailed what made this film so quite lovely, whereas it was like, this is a tribute to Studio Ghibli. And I don't want to give away, much like The Power of the Dog, the twist on the plot is revealed relatively early on in the film here, but I just thought it was lovely. Like, there's just something about watching young people making pancakes and dealing with grief and helping each other through a really tough time. It's one of those ones where it's just a really lovely special idea, and a film that you can just dive into the cinema. And the amount of times I've spoken about films need to be edited, insane run times, I thought this one just hit the sweet spot, and it was a fantastic follow-up to Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I wish I loved it more. I think I definitely need to rewatch it when it maybe drops onto Mubi. But yeah, a really, really lovely film with some, you know, lovely performances to the heart from young leads.
Yeah, no, I was really taken by this one as well. I saw London Film Festival, and yeah, we'll stay away from the central plot twist. Is it a twist? No, for me it felt very much like, I can't even say the things without sort of giving away what it might be, but it felt almost like a children's book brought to life. You know, children's books are, you know, great, you know, to share stories to share with your children, they entertain them, put them to sleep, but they also have like a message behind them or something, or a fable, moral of a story, and that's what this does. This is about sort of dealing with grief and loss through a child's perspective. And what I really liked with they employed like the ET trick of basically filming everything from the child's point of view, so everything sort of low down, sometimes the adults right shot and stuff like that. And yeah, no, it was really, really taken with it, and I think it's a film which, you know, a lot of people are gonna love. I think it could become, you know, a children's classic. It felt for me like a sort of like The Secret Garden in some sort of ways. Obviously there's the subtitle barrier for some people, but perhaps, you know, maybe you might be able to get children to watch it. Maybe there might be a different version, but I think the two girls in it are fantastic, and it's just a really sweet, lovely film. And yeah, like you say, it has a very short running time, but it's the perfect running time for that film. I think if it had been longer or shorter, then it might not have been as effective, but I think it was just a really sweet, lovely film. And yeah, Skyama can do it all. practically at this point in time. You know, I don't think there's a better storyteller of female characters and female relationships than her at the moment. So
here's a question. So we've got kind of four big and small movies this week. If you're to use your hard-earned cinema money to go see something, what would you pick and recommend?
Well, you know, I probably would say Ghostbusters Afterlife, you know, to be honest, because I know that it's got a couple of them are going to be out on Netflix and Mubi soon as well. So,
yeah, I'm going to go with a similar approach. I think The Power of the Dog is a great one to see on the big screen, but I would probably say King Richard is one of those rare movies that you can see with your family, your parents, take some young kids along and all get something from it. Yeah, just a lovely, lovely movie. And yeah, I probably consider it a bit of a dark horse now for the Oscars. I think there's a lot more better films than King Richard this year that I would put up for it first, but I have a feeling King Richard could be the dark horse going forward.
The kind of sort of audience friendly, you know, popular choice. Will Smith will get a nomination. What else it wins, however, I guess we'll need to see once the nominations hit.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be back next week where we'll be able to discuss a new Ridley Scott movie. I wonder if this one will also generate an insane amount of discourse, but we'll all be putting our phones down and going to see The House of Gucci on Friday and talking about it with you all next week. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.